Richard Wagamese is an Ojibwe poet and author, well known across Canada. He's written a book of reflections called Embers. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. In it, he writes, "Fog drifts across the harbor the way a cat slinks across a room. And in that jaw-dropping silence are mystery and elegance and power. Sitting here on a morning gray as stone in a city on an island tucked against a mountain, you come to realize how dynamic living a planet can be when you remember that we're on one. This great island tucked against the bowl of space is home. It is majestic and at the same time a humble being, allowing us to grow and evolve. Aki, Earth. I will walk her skin today, attuned to her heartbeat, the feel of her thrumming against the soles of my feet." This is First Nation Sunday, and the thought in my mind was that this service need be about us, those who are called colonizers, and rightly we are. This needs to be about us on our side of the discussion this morning. Canada is my First Nation, you see. It is my home and native land. I have been raised in its essence. I am stunned by its beauty, and I live in the air of its freedom. It makes me proud. It grounds me as a person. My heart sings of its freedom and privilege. These are the best things of my home and native land. But at worst, it lulls me into forgetting the profound struggles of other people in the world and in this land. This is an island of safety here, seemingly, in a world of chaos. Only this morning on the news, we heard that 600 people who were fleeing sub-Saharan Africa from 27 countries were finally allowed to leave a rescue ship in Valencia, Spain, after Italy and Malta refused them entrance. People just like us, only nearly drowning in the Mediterranean Sea because they are fleeing things we can hardly imagine and want simply a better life among us. And people in our own country, First Nations people, dislocated people, wherever they may be found, tortured people, tormented people, coming from things we can hardly imagine and experiencing things here we can hardly fathom, people who have broken the rules of public expectation and are paying the price, and people who have fallen through the cracks of the social safety net. Now, I too can write poetry about the beauty of my country, and I do it. Indeed, the other day, sitting in my little shed at the cottage by myself early in the morning with the sun shining down and the birds singing in the trees, I wrote, "I see a future beyond this shed door. The faithful sun is rising from the quiet east. The waving fields are green and growing. They will grow some more. In these early morning moments, there seems only ease. I see promise beyond this shed door. There is inviting softness of some masterpiece calling for my touch. Life means so much to me now. May all self-carnage cease amid such landscapes of this calm, uncommon peace." And I need to feel that about my country. I need to feel the patriotism, the pride, the gratitude about my country. And I do. But I need to feel something more besides. I need somebody higher and older and wiser to teach me about my country as a parable. Now, a parable is something simple laid alongside something profound, so that both parts are illuminated. It is said that Jesus spoke in parables, inviting us in to see the parabolic arch in the story and to reach out for the meaning of it. Canada is a profound place. It is a parable, and we catch facets of its meaning every so often. We live in a land of 1,000 stories. Most of them are private. We'll never hear them. Some of them are public, and we hear them too often. Some stories melt the hearts. Some stories shatter the hearts here in our country. And so in the first parable, the parable of Samuel, Saul, and David, I see the danger of cultural entitlement. Divine judgment will bring itself against cultural entitlements, right there in the story. We are together breathing something deeper. Elitism, special favors, in whatever form they take, will bring down empire after empire because the Creator of all things says it is so. Richard Wagamese writes, "On a windy day many summers ago, a hawk hurtled straight down at me. 10 feet above my head, she spread her wings and stopped in mid-dive. I heard the whoosh of her wings against the sound of the wind and the exhalation of my own breath. 3 things collided in an instant: wind, hawk, breath. There was no separation. We were connected, joined by air. In the flash of that sacred moment, I understood what it is to be alive, to be connected, to be aware of the connection. To breathe is to take in the wind of all breath. To exhale slowly is to be open to glide over everything I feel." Now, the story of Samuel and Saul and David begins with a terrible verse. The verse reads, "And Samuel hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal." Hacked Agag to pieces before the Lord at Gilgal. Well, what's going on? There was a war, and according to the story, the great God had said to Israel, "You have to win this war. If you do not win this war, you will lose everything we have given. And so you must fight to win this war." And of course, the war went on, and the soldiers from both sides went out to fight, and Israel was indeed winning the war, but Saul the king saw his fellow king, Agag, the king on the other side, and said, "Well, we're both kings. Maybe we can cut each other a little bit of slack here. Why don't you come and have a drink with me, and we'll talk about dividing up the spoils. I'll get most of them, and you can have yours, and then you can go to your island, which you bought by hiding money in offshore accounts, and I'll go to my island, and we'll have a good time. And then let the common folk kill each other." And then Samuel came up and said, "The Lord said that we all win or we all lose. And you have done something which shows special interest, elitism, someone selling armaments to both sides, someone making secret deals in back rooms." Do you think it happens in modern situations, in modern wars? Do you think it happens? It happened in Canada. This land was used as a battleground for European empires and European dreams, French and English, fighting against each other on our soil, in our shared soil, and First Nations people being dragged into it on one side or the other. Not their fight, but our fight for pride and nationalism and secret deals and all the rest is part of our history. And since then, as a nation, we have shown rage as late as last week. Read the newspapers, read the Facebook posts. How dare the President of the United States call our Prime Minister a coward? Does he not know who we're dealing with? We'll stand up, all of us. All the political parties will stand up. Nobody calls us cowards. There they are, the rage of it. And we cast insults back and forth at each other. How terrible the enemy is. We stereotype the enemy. They're all terrorists. They're all drug dealers. They're all people who hate us. They're all condemned. They're all wife beaters. They're all whatever. And we've shown hatred as a country. We turned away Jews, a shipload of Jews, in the middle of the Second World War and consigned them to death in the death camps of Germany. And we interred Japanese citizens on the West Coast, moved them to the middle of Canada and interred them, and refused to give them back the land we promised to give them back when the conflict was over. And we've shown racism, a constant fear and oppression towards people of color. We feel it and acknowledge it today, every day on our streets, and we stereotype foreigners, and we call them, and we call us, us, and we show resistance to difference. The fear of the immigrant, oh, they're all criminals and drug dealers and robbers and belong to street gangs and biker gangs. We know about them, the immigrants. They've come to take our jobs and to take our life. And yet we've shown mercy to as a country, humbled, strong. Do you remember humbled, strong? Good wishes and care and help and goods and money from Canada across the nation and all over the world for the families of those who lost those lovely young hockey players in a catastrophic accident. And we brought in Vietnamese boat people by the tens of thousands and welcomed Syrian refugees to our land and to this congregation. And we, you know, about Come From Away, we're all singing the songs, the glories of Newfoundland. How can anyone forget? But the parable declares that the battle for a great country will be lost if retrenchment and special favors block the truth, justice, and love. The parable says that the Creator of the world is anointing a new child, and that new child is out there somewhere, and despite all the backroom dealings and the worry, that new child will rise to prominence and become the ruler of the new land. Well, that's one parable of Canada. The Corinthian text offers a subtle parable about the power behind truth-telling and fair dealing and respectful concern for others. Are these just choices among choices? Do we really have to choose one or the other? Or are there enough shades of gray in all of them to say, well, I think we'll do whatever expedient today. We may change our minds tomorrow. Is what we know to be the wisest and most deeply true in life even considered by us anymore? Or are we expedient every day? The first thing that power-minded, threatened cultures always do is to silence the wise, the broad, the kind, the daring, the brave, the poets, the authors, the playwrights, the teachers, the researchers, the dissident political voices, the might of the young. Shuts them all down so only one voice at the top can be heard. They bring out the riot police, the National Guard, the gun, and the heavy end of the law every time. The parable suggests we may see everything in a new way if we dare. All great religions wrestle for the truth they found at the heart of themselves. Now, we may lose the truth now and then. We may get stuck on some form of doing business or another, or one persuasive voice that takes us down a road we later find to be unhelpful, and we have to backtrack all the way back to the main highway. But someone always breaks through and helps us to go deeper in all this. You see, there's a spirit alive among us all that leads us towards caring and compassion and kindness and a quest for forgiveness and reconciliation. It even equips us to sacrifice our own life for the betterment of a truer friend, a truer way of being and living. Looking back on our nation's past, we see good things, but we have to acknowledge an imbalance that kills people. Treaty promises have been broken. The great mother in Britain made promises, and they have been broken by her sons and daughters here. We see it, and we know it, and we seemingly tinker with it, but refuse to do the hard thing, the right thing, to make it right. Now, it's easy for me to look at the state of Israel and see the intentional building of communities on land that belongs to the Palestinian territory, building them and building them and building, and suppressing the lives of those who protest, and basically capturing a people in their own land, and I see how profoundly wrong it is, and I hear voices of the world crying out against it, an obvious wrong. And when it comes to us in this country, who in many ways are doing the same thing, we just can't turn the crank on it. Nobody wants to take the risk. Nobody wants to lose anything. If you give them this, then we don't have it anymore. And all the things we say to each other. We had a security consultant come in this week to talk to us about security at Metropolitan Church in a changing downtown. He was quite an excellent, excellent speaker. He had been the head of security, designing secure systems for the Invictus Games and for the Pan Am Games, a giant in his field. And he said, I want to talk to you about two theories. And one of the theories is the theory about trash. You'll notice that in public buildings and government buildings and in malls, there's no trash on the floors. Whenever someone drops a piece of something, someone comes immediately and picks it up, because nobody wants to be the first one to drop a piece of trash. If you keep the trash away, the heart of your enterprise will remain clean. So he said to us, if you don't pick up the trash in the park outside, even the jewel in the middle of it all will become trash-filled because permission has been given not to clean up that which is necessary to clean up. The other was the broken window theory, that if a building is abandoned and someone breaks the window and it isn't repaired right away, someone else will come and break the next window and the next. And before long, it will not simply be abandoned buildings whose windows are broken. It will be operating storefronts and restaurants and any other window someone wants to break. You have to keep the window glass fresh and clean so you can see through it and see the world in which you really want to live. I took it all in, and I heard it deeply. Now, the Mark passage takes the form of two parables of Jesus, and one is about sowing seeds in a vast field and then being on hand to do our part in harvesting the crop when it rises. Life unfolds, says the parable. We can't control it. We don't see its ultimate outcome ever. We just see that there are seeds being sown, and we throw them into the ground of our experience, and where they're going to go, nobody knows. When I was about 10 years old, my cousin Bruce, who's my closest cousin, and I, on a winter's day, decided we would go to the steps of the Don Valley. Bad idea. We took a toboggan with us. Bad idea. And we sat at the top of a set of long, steep stairs, all snow-covered. And we sat down on the toboggan, and we said to ourselves, well, we can go down this one step at a time. You just plant your feet, let one little step go, and then you plant your feet at the second step, and after 10 minutes, we'll be at the bottom, safe and sound. Well, we lifted our heels off the snow, and the toboggan went like a rocket. The stairwell turned, and we didn't, and we went sailing off into the woods, and we laughed and laughed until we realized my cousin had put a small gash in his head. He saw the blood drip down on his nose and cried all the way home. You can sow the seeds, but you don't know how the growth is going to turn out. We sow seeds, we wait, we evaluate, we adjust, and we harvest as broadly as we can. Now, Jesus warns us that the harvest is going to be mixed. Wheat and tares are always going to grow up together, and it's only at the end when it's harvest time that we must bring our best minds and hearts to decide what is of value and what is to be burned. Jesus says the harvest will vary. Some ground will bear nothing. Some seeds will be eaten by birds. Some will be stamped upon because they're in a main path that no one is willing to honor. But there'll be a small group of seeds that will grow and give such bounty that it will feed everyone who is hungry. We win, we lose, we're tight, we're loose, we're kind, we're cruel, we're restless, we're satisfied, we swing to the left, we swing to the right. That is the nature of life in Canada. But the seeds are being planted and the vast crops are growing, and we are to be aware and to be ready to make the best harvest. The other parable of Jesus is about the sheer chaos and bounty that occurs when little overtures start to bring big changes. We were just planting a little seed. We didn't think they would go this far. The mustard seed, says Jesus, is the smallest of all seeds. You put it in the ground and you forget about it, but to your amazement, it grows into the largest of all bushes, and it's fruitful beyond your imagining. And then suddenly, the birds start to come. They want to feed. Everyone wants to feed and feed their young. They start to come by the thousands, and they fill the tree. And then they notice that the neat colonial Roman imperial rows of vegetables are growing right next door, and the birds say, I'll have some of this, and some of that, and some of them. And before long, the birds from the mustard seed bush are all over the imperial rows of vegetables that were earmarked for other people. And that's just the way it goes, said Jesus. Chaos disrupts the order every time, and we are prepared to live creatively in the chaos together. When you have a discussion about First Nations and reconciliation, you're inviting reconciliation, but you're also inviting some measure of social change and potential chaos. I think Krista Freeland spoke for us the other day nobly in the United States when she said to our American neighbors, no empire lasts forever. We must be humbled by our participation in the passage of time and in the changing of the world. Choose your friends well and treat them well. We are all only passing through. Richard Wagamese writes, like most of us, I spend a lot of time trying to compress things into a context I could accept. That was hard work, and it meant I was alone most of the time. Nowadays, I figure life is pretty simple. Creator is everything, the divine light shines through everything and is everything. My work is to look for the light in those fleeting, glorious instances when I see it. I am made more right then, right there. Now, the people of faith, may well be the very ones to walk the border between alienation and reconciliation. Did you think that? We may be the very ones. We have been invaded by foreign forces over the centuries. We have been overrun. Strangers have brought conflicting values to our life and our way of seeing things. We have seen values denied and our ways ridiculed. We have known torture and imprisonment, social shunning, banishment, refusal of our natural tongue. We have had our vocabulary found faulty. We have faced legal restrictions and social rejection. That's the history of the church across 2,000 years in the world. We have lived through the whole range of human experience, fair and foul. Let us not forget it. But we've also acknowledged that we have a quest at heart which cannot be denied, and it is a quest which will be filled with love and kindness and will transform the world, and we are encouraged to live for that. So this confession from the pen of Richard Wolgamese may well apply to us too. Listen. Something that most do not understand about my people when we stand up in acts of resistance to things that threaten our spiritual, physical, emotional, and intellectual well-being, it is not because we hate what's in front of us. It's because we love what's behind us. We love our homes, our families, our communities, our nations, our ceremonies, our teachings, our cultural ways, our histories, and the land that those things spring from. In that, we are like anyone else, anywhere throughout the course of human history who has ever stood up to injustice. Stay brown, he writes. Stay brown.